It's my great pleasure to introduce the next speaker, Andreas Girardet. Andreas is Novell's Linux evangelist. He's a German-speaking Italian with a French surname, and he presently lives in Auckland. He was the founder of New Zealand's first Linux distribution, which is called Yopa, and is actually still running, although he's, I don't believe, still involved with that. And he's also an all-round nice guy. He's going to be talking about the War of the Words, so give it up for Andreas. Big hand. Let's get ready to rumble!
Okay. Mike, okay? Right. G'day. G'day, Wellington. Here we go. A bit about myself. That chap up there with the glasses is a geek, right? A real one, not one with a Microsoft at the back. Sorry, the t-shirts out there say geek. I'm a real one, as it comes, like yourself. Let's be proud of it. There are a bit of your email addresses if you want to contact me. I obviously done a few websites in my past. My past is actually in the ISP environment, so I used to be a colleague of yours, helping web designers out with servers that would run and run and run on Linux. And yeah, as such, I've had a 10-year career in New Zealand, and now I'm at Novell and fighting for Linux, and I'm at war, as you will see today. What are we here today for? We are here for open source software, open standards, and the success of the web. Every single one of you has a job because of it. Think about it. Every single one of you has a job because of open standards. Without it, you wouldn't be here today. What does Novell do for open source software? And what can Novell do for you? Thank you all for creating the web. I'd like to please clap, every single one. To yourself, thank you, everyone. You've made it happen. We've all got a job because you guys believe in open standards and in the possibility a networked environment gives you. Novell obviously has created in the 80s networked environments in businesses and has pushed it very far. What are open standards, right? Or what are they used for? I mean, we know what they are, but they are used for effective communication. No effective communication works without open standards. You couldn't understand me if there wouldn't be an open standard called the English language, right? They are the basis for open source development. They're the basis of the development of the net. And they are basis for what you do every day. You probably won't see much out there. It just gives you a bit of an overview of the history of the internet. You all know it. I mean, it started with ARPANET. But the most important aspect of here really is that from about 1981 onwards, when the standard actually for the internet with TCP, IP, TCP was set, the development progressed fairly slowly until about the early 90s when it really took off. And we all know it took about 15 years for it to really take off. So from the inception of the open standard to the actual commercialization to today, where it's 25 years later, where the web really rules, we have a 15 to 25 year period where the commercialization actually happens. Linux was founded in 1991. That's 15 years from then. So the open standard set with Linus Torvalds has taken 15 years' time, and we are in its full start of its commercialization now. So let's look forward to the next 10 years. 30% of new servers today are shipped with Linux. You probably run yourself Linux servers in the back end, or at least you use open source software somewhere. You use it every day. Every website is very likely to use open source software, so when you visit a website, when you develop for a website, it's all based on open source software and on open standards. What happened to CompuServe? Look at a proprietary company that said it was very successful in the 80s with a proprietary network, and, well, they pretty much disappeared. It's some arm still of AOL, but as a proprietary network, they're gone. The internet really, really moved them completely out of the historical picture. So if you see up there, we've obviously got the development on the left, the hosts, Netcraft's very famous host table of how many hosts there are. It's increasing, ever increasing, and at the bottom right, you see the amount of Apache web servers running compared to the RAID one, which is Internet Information Server. People rely on Apache. It's a very, very good piece of software, as much as they rely, obviously, on other technologies, but that's certainly one of the successful bits that made the web so successful. Thank you all for using open source software every day. It comes from the bottom of my heart. I myself wouldn't have a job if you wouldn't have used it. I wouldn't have been a system admin. I wouldn't be able to stand here today and say what I say, right? So thank you again. Truth, right? There's, for me, the concept of words has a lot to do with truth. You can use words, of course, also to describe lies or to have more of a marketing approach to life. For me, as a geek and as a pretty scientific mind, truth is very fundamental to what I do. Truth means that the standards I put down are valued or discussed in the open, and you find the right way to do things, and that becomes the truth. So the standard itself then becomes the standard to which truth is actually matched on. And in such a development environment, you usually have, you have two camps today, right? You have the closed source guys whose approach it is, I'm the king in my domain. I can decide. I sit in my office. I know what I have to write. I get told by the project manager what to write. And once I've finished, I give it into the bigger project, bigger picture of the project. And the code usually doesn't really get reviewed unless there is a bug. In the open approach, it's really on the opposite way. So the team discusses frankly about anything that has to do with any code changes, alteration, or features. You have a team that reviews the algorithms fairly consistently throughout the development process. And you have the code that gets completely reviewed all the time once it's checked into a code source system and by users and developers. The users use it, the developers check it out. So the interaction is very fluid. It's a very scientific approach. It reminds me a lot about the times I was at university where you actually discussed about things and you came to a scientific outcome. It is a very similar approach. So it's based on truth and not on a feudalistic system based on I'm the king. Right? The pyramids. What have the pyramids to do with open source software? If you look at how a normal skyscraper or any commercial building is built, it's built in a very similar manner as you would think closed source software is built. So you have teams of people, contractors, coming together and building this building. They usually, once they're finished, they go away, they move away, or they do another building. They don't really have an emotional connection to that building. It's a job. They build this up pretty quickly, and then they go away. What happens in the closed source world is very much similar to a monumental effort like building pyramids. You've got a huge amount of people, including yourself, using and developing this building. And of course, building a pyramid takes a long time. It takes a lot of people to build something as big as a pyramid. Still today, we cannot build pyramids. It's a fact. We cannot build pyramids. But what we can do is use a similar monumental effort to actually build software. And that's the open source approach. It's exactly like that. People are emotionally connected with their pyramid. We know today, for example, that it was only a small amount of slaves actually building the pyramids. The rest were people who believed they would be immortal because of helping the pharaoh to become immortal. They themselves would become immortal. So this emotional connection that we see in open source developers like Ben and myself, this passion that comes through, that doesn't leave just because maybe they leave the project, that stays there and will be with them forever. They will always, always be very friendly with their project. The birth of the web itself, if we go a step back again, this is the first email really that's been written about it, and what CERN in 1990 started to think about how to develop something that's a bit more appealing than Gopher. I can remember those times. And they proposed a simple scheme incorporating servers already available at CERN. So it was the basis for their development there. The birth of Linux happened pretty much at the same time, about a year later. And this is Linus Torvalds' announcement. I would like to read it because it just shows how from one small email, 15 years later, we have people following their livelihoods. We have a market that is increasing every day. We have some companies that are getting scared of it because obviously the traditional markets are in the opposite spectrum. They build skyscraper. We build something lasting like a pyramid. That's pretty scary for somebody that builds a skyscraper. I'm doing a free OS, just a hobby. Won't be big and professional like GNU for 386, 486, AT clones. This has been brewing since April and is starting to get ready. I'd like any feedback on things people like, dislike in Minix. SMIOS resembles somewhat. Same physical layout of the file system due to practical reasons, among other things. And he goes on saying, I've already ported a few software that's available in the GNU spectrum onto Linux. Look, here's a humble guy. Here's a humble guy that says, I've got an idea. It's a very scientific view. My need is that I've got a 386, and I want this machine to actually do what it's supposed to do with the mathematical coprocessors in it. And I don't want to spend money on it. I feel that I can learn more from it by doing it myself. Does somebody want to help me? Of course people wanted to help him. Look what happened. Look, I'm running on Linux today. Mr. Gates and the web, obviously, I don't know if you can see that, but there's a bit of cream pie in the face of Mr. G. Mr. G obviously did not think the internet would really take off. When Windows 95 came out, MSN was bundled with it, and the strategy was clearly to probably more combat companies like CompuServe, which was at that time certainly quite an important company still. And quickly, they had to adapt. The internet really, 96, took off, and they had to react. Microsoft's first online service, MSN, then developed into what we know from MSN today. But originally, if some of you can remember, I'm sure, it was a proprietary service. The internet will never take off? Has it? Some people are visionaries and some are commercialists. Science versus marketing. Linus says about the way he works and the way he works says the following. I'm generally a very pragmatic person that which works, works. When it comes to software, I much prefer free software because I've very seldom seen a program that has worked well enough for my needs. And having sources available can be a lifesaver. So in that sense, I'm an avid promoter of free software and GPL stuff in particular, because once it's GPL'd, I know it's going to stay free, so I don't have to worry about future releases. However, that does not mean that I'm opposed to commercial software. Commercial software development has some advantages too. The money-making aspect introduces some new incentives that aren't there for most free software. And those incentives often make for a more polished product. And that's what Novell obviously is in business for. We unite proprietary and open source software and exactly to achieve an extremely highly polished product that companies can deploy and can rely financially on. Is it the truth? Well, Mr. G probably couldn't get barred in New Zealand because he got obviously caught drink driving. I didn't. I probably could get barred. The truth is that, for example, on a question that Windows has many bugs, would you address that? Mr. G said, no, there are no significant bugs in our released software that any significant number of users want fixed. Right. Funny. It's marketing, the approach of the non-truth compared to the truth, science compared to pure, simple lies. I see it. Adoption time frame for open standards is, over the last 50 years, it has certainly quite dramatically increased. When the book printing came out as a pretty open standard and revolutionized the world, it took much longer. These days, we can probably talk about a 15-year time frame from the time a standard gets put in the out there and then it gets implemented. With Linux, we are there right now. 15 years ago, it was started. We are getting into the prime time. So you are already depending on it, even though maybe you don't even know it. You do. Anyone does. Anyone on the internet does. Linux is inevitable. So if you haven't joined it now, now is the time. All right, a little bit of a marketing slide. You can see this is an IDC study that just shows simply Linux is growing. Everyone else is either shrinking or staying stable. Here we go. Linux is the right choice. As SUSE, we have in our Enterprise version 9 release, we have achieved EL4 plus certification, which is a security standard certification. Again, open standard, standards set down by governments, that to achieve that, and we have achieved it perfectly because from ground up, our standards, obviously, we are already complying to those standards. So it's when it comes to certification times, so when somebody certifies you to a certain standard, you actually achieve it fairly easily. And that's what we've done very much so with SUSE in the last years. We are open and flexible. The source code is available to anyone, providing trust and flexibility. You can consolidate platforms, common operating system across multiple hardware platforms. On the bottom, you have Linux. The total cost of ownership gets reduced dramatically. I mean, from an ISP perspective, every time I've worked for various ISPs, every time we did projects and we compared, even if I had to do a proprietary solution for people like Extra, for example, I always did say and did do a cost proposal with the open source version. And in a mail server environment, for example, and I can actually talk about it, when we built the Extra mail server, the last one or the current one that's running, I was the technical lead. It cost $6 million, right? And to do the same thing with open source software, it would have costed us $600,000. Now, if you're telecom, today maybe they think different, but certainly in those days they go, well, $6 million, fine, let's just pay it. But not everyone is telecom, obviously, and everyone else has to look out for themselves and not just squander their money. Linux compared to Windows, a few stats. Linux, you've certainly heard about a few of those. Linux has better reliability and stability. It is comparable in stability to many commercial Unixes. It has features and a well-architected kernel. Linux is stronger in security. It is less prone to viruses, and it has certainly a lower amount of very, very virulent attacks. You know, when the internet stops working, it is usually because of a very, very large Slammer attack, for example, that was a big one that really made the internet crawl. Linux is less costly to customize and deploy in your environment. And for example, Windows XP in beta is only available from an OEM, and that OEM has to do the image customization for you. With our software, it's all there in the open. You can do it yourself. It's very easy to do. Linux has more flexible hardware support because it supports more hardware architectures, more CPUs, more chipsets, and so on. It is certainly the times are gone where Linux only ran, didn't even have CD-ROM support. The first time I installed Linux was 94, and Linux didn't have CD-ROM support. It just was put into the kernel, and to actually be able to install Linux from a CD, Slackware 2 in those days, I had to recompile my kernel, which was really frightening in those days. Today, it's all fine. It's quite amazing. What does Novell do for open source software? We've got, we acquired about 2 years ago a Linux distribution called SUSE. That was before my time. I'm a Linux guy, so I certainly don't know anything about NetWare. But Linux itself, Novell recognized very early on, and that's talking about the 90s, that open source is a very exciting development. And when it came down to it, they actually then invested very heavily in acquiring companies. And what I've seen the last year at Novell, this company is not the same company where I started, even a year ago. It has changed dramatically. The culture is open. I'm able to tell my chief executive officer pretty much what I think without any worries, there of repercussions. It is actually wanted and needed. This is the culture, the open source culture. It is not a culture of hierarchy where you shut up just because you're lower. It's a culture of you will speak because you've got obviously an opinion. You're probably even smarter than some of the guys that are leading you. And they need you to succeed, right? They want to succeed themselves. An open source project works in a very similar manner. Open source projects work in a very similar manner. There's open discussion. So as a company, we base ourselves on that. And obviously, we take the best out of open source projects and put it into our Linux distribution. Once we've done some integration testing, we basically create, within this OpenSUSE project, a distribution. We take the source code, we compile it in large clusters of machines with an auto-built system where the system is constantly compiling any change that developer has injected into it. This is done in the open. This is done as part of a project called OpenSUSE. And here we go. Once we've done some selection and QA process, we release a product. This is a retail product, which is called SUSE Linux. Right? At the moment, we've just announced the release of SUSE Linux 10.1. And once we've done that, we've done this release, we actually work on an enterprise release after we've done some hardening, and we sell that with a certain amount of, you know, you've got 7 years of patches, you get a lot of patches, you get upgrades with it, you are sure that you will have a stable enterprise-ready release to run on HP hardware, on IBM hardware, on any certified hardware. So that's when the enterprise release then comes out. It's on the basis of the SUSE Linux project. This is also quite an interesting diagram because it shows where many other projects differ, right? So for example, non-commercial Linuxes obviously do not have a SUSE Linux Enterprise or something similar. There are plenty of those, about 300 Linux distros and some out there. Then you've got some distros that might have a community release, but don't really have a connection between that community release and their enterprise release, because how they think is more of a proprietary, they have more of a proprietary approach. For example, Fedora is a good example, where there is really no code, there's a huge code difference between their actual open release and the final release. Our release is based on the community release because we trust the process, in the community, and we want to follow it to the iota, to the last bit. So the SUSE development process shows you that a project like SUSE, an open source project, can very well come into after certain steps onto a stage where it can earn money, and that's what we're in business for, and we've got very large customers doing that. A large implementation, for example, is in Australia. Supercomputer is a good example. Obviously, they've got 5,000 machines, CPUs, and that runs on SUSE Linux, largest supercomputer in the Southern Hemisphere, and some. I could mention hundreds. Some of the open source engagements we have, obviously, the main website for it is opensuse.org. We've got Yast, which is our system administration tool. I'll demo it soon. We have Mono, which is our implementation of the open standard .NET. Thank you, Microsoft. It was a very good idea for Microsoft to open that standard because it allowed us to actually comply to that standard. And so today, if you take an EXE from that's been compiled under .NET, it will actually very likely just run. And the migration path, if there is one, is very simple because the same language, it's the same standard being implemented in the libraries that we do in our Mono project. And you can run web services if you program in .NET on Linux under Mono. iFolder 3 is a file sharing application we have for companies. AppArmor is a security application that wraps around an application to make it more secure, and so on. So there are many, many projects we are involved in. We've got about 1,000 developers, really hardcore coders, that are just there to code, right? That's full-time employees. OpenSUSE project has another 15,000 developers that help them on a day-to-day basis. I think we're getting there from a size perspective where even a large distribution like Debian will certainly see that we have a similar structure and certainly a similar base now going forward. The OpenSUSE community, two addresses. One is the build server. So if you are a code writer, go there, subscribe. It's an alpha at the moment. It will allow you to compile your package for various distributions, not just for SUSE, in an automatic build system, in a public build service. It's built on Ruby and Rails, so also the web developers around in here, they can help making that better. It's an open effort. All right, so we are launching SUSE Linux Enterprise 10, which is quite fantastic. The 10th release of SUSE. Built-in application security, virtualization built-in, integrated system management, support of the full range of hardware architectures, 7 hardware architectures. In SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop 10, which is our desktop version, which I'm going to demo very shortly, we've got new levels of productivity. And I'll probably skip that and just go further and finish off into the demo. This is our structure. What can we do for you? We can do anything in the data center. We can do anything on the desktop. We can do anything on the work group environment. We can do anything in resource management. We can do anything in security identity. Who else can say that? What other open source company can say that? Name me one. Right? There ain't none. Novell, as an open source company, is de facto the leader because nobody else has the bandwidth and the history to actually compete in a marketplace that is today dominated by one player. Not us, unfortunately, yet. Right? Don't forget that. The reality is one. What I'm saying to you is that it is inevitable because open standards take a certain time to actually be implemented. And we have not just the best story, we have the best engineers, we have the best truth behind us. Why use Novell for Linux? Novell reduces the barrier of broad adoption to Linux. It is a well-known company. It has 800 support engineers on top of the developers that are dedicated 24/7 to actually help you to support the environment. And we've got thousands of partners worldwide in a very large partner network that can help you to implement things. If you are often, I've met a few partners here in the last few days of our company. So it is a very strong network. Talk to us, anything to do with your environment, really. Any one of you has access to servers. You should be running SUSE because you know it is dependable, it is faster, there is German engineering behind it. You're basically running a Mercedes on your machine, right? But not with the price tag of a Mercedes. It's the price tag of Toyota or something. But it's certainly, German engineering has, in my perspective, one edge, and that is they're very detailed on things. The detail, obviously, in a demo like that, I can't really go into much, unfortunately. Let's go a bit further. Novell gives you the choice to run any Linux and Windows application natively with technologies from our partners to deliver a consolidated Linux and Windows network where applications are delivered to Linux or Windows desktops via thin client infrastructure. This, we do this via terminal servers, no machine, and Slate. This is the key. Linux doesn't just run Linux natively, right? Okay, there's a bit of smoke and mirrors behind. We've got a terminal server in the back, but this is the way it works. And we can cut the cost down dramatically by having no functionality loss, no application loss to a tenth of the price. Now, isn't that a value add? Isn't that a value add? It has to happen, isn't it? It's inevitable. Free your money from slavery now. It costs you $130 for a one-user license of Novell Open Workgroup Suite. That includes Open Enterprise Server, Slay's GroupWise Server on Linux, ZenWorks Suite, Linux Desktop, and even a supported version of OpenOffice for Windows. Very, very strong position. Usually, the average company is about $500 to up to $1,000 in cost for just for the base software, right, on a pure Windows network. $130 compared to that is just very good value. And you don't lose productivity, you win stability, you win productivity by having a usable system. All right, let's get into the fun bit. Here we go. See this? It's a T-shirt of the Wine Project with a bit drunk penguin at the back. All right, so what I'm running here is SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop 10. And I've got a little paper here. Here we go. What we've actually done, compared to many, many geek projects, that where a geek sits in his little basement and says, I know what users want, right? Then he develops this piece of software, and users might start using it because they don't have much choice. But if you actually look at things, many, many things in the Linux desktop, how it used to be, it was pretty clear to me for many years that it wasn't very user-friendly. Now, our engineers have said the logical thing. Well, to make it user-friendly, any web designer knows that, we make usability studies. We put people in front of it and let them use it and let them do feedback. Right? So what we did is we filmed those people on the project and put those films online on a project called betterdesktop.org. And those videos film people in various actions. Send an email to your friend and go to a website and post a picture of yourself there, and so on and so on. What we've noticed is that to actually be able to have non-Linux users use Linux productively from day one, everything needs to be searchable, findable, and pretty much three clicks away. Well, as a web guy myself, I can tell you, well, three-click principle has been around for a while, and I hate websites still that go beyond that because they're very, very difficult to use. And the three-click principle has been consistently applied throughout our operating system, throughout our UI. For example, this panel that you see here has been developed in Mono. It could run on Windows, probably. Why would you, though? Here we go. You've got a panel where you've got your favorite applications there, Firefox, Banshee, F-Spot, Evolution, certain other programs that have really funny names. You've got a search up there, and I'll go through that a bit more. And you've got a control center, so everything is there with one click. You know you've got a control center there, you can install software there, you can lock your screen, you see how much disk on your hard disk is free. And you've got, you can see what kind of network connection you have on there. So it's all very visible quickly. In the control center, one of the things that those usability studies told us is that users need a very simple way to actually change anything. And so we did a control center with many, many simple tasks that were in, you know, 1, 2, 3 clicks, you're actually in there to change your background. Or 1, 2, 3 clicks, you set up your scanner. 1, 2, 3 clicks, you set up your network card. 1, 2, 3 clicks, and you have a fancy desktop layout, or you change your theme. Then we have obviously a tool called Yast. This tool is very powerful for administrators indeed. I'll just quickly open it up and show you what features, what possibilities it actually allows you to do. Linux is not just for the command line. I could admin this system completely without the command line. I choose not to. I like the command line, but our customers obviously want GUI tools, and many people need GUI tools. They work, right? So, and in this Yast, yet another system administration tool, we have many, many things you can do. You can create a whole DHCP server, web server, everything GUI with a graphical user interface to be able to actually manage that. And Yast is very unique. No other distro has such a consistent administration tool like Yast, such a consistent and easy-to-use administration tool. We've got a network applet, which one of the coolest features is that I have actually a list of all the networks that are available here, and I could join the different networks, Bing, and if I know the key, obviously, and some. But you can actually war drive with this laptop straight away. You don't actually need to do anything fancy if you want to do that and just see, freak your friend out when you suddenly surf his internet connection and his telecom bill comes home. So you probably won't want to do that, but it's certainly a usability thing. People said wireless just needs to work. Bang, done, it does. We've got VPN clients on here where we can connect to many, many different VPN systems. Also another thing, for corporates that's very important. You need to be able to connect to your corporate VPN. We've got a little note-taking application here. You can just click on there and create a new note, and so you need to remember to drink water. All right. Yeah, that's right. Remember not to drink water, I just typed, so I'll just remember to drink water. Here we go. So this little note-taking device, and if I look at it again, oh yeah, what's it? What's my note here again? I remember to drink water, right. So a little tools like that that make life really simple are already integrated. What you also have, and the biggest problem also was in all these Linux desktops, is that you couldn't change resolution on the fly. I've done it before. I won't do it now. But you've got so many resolutions available. Click, click, and you actually change it. I won't do it now. I'm going to go through the demo, actually. Find data is one of the things, finding things, right? You don't want to drop to command line and type find and grep for that. That looks a bit ugly, right? And you also often don't really get what's in the file. So, for example, if I look for something as simple as Linux on my disk, here we go. This application actually allows you to search for that, and at the moment I've got quite a few things on there, as you can say. On the top, we've got applications that have Linux in the name. We have contacts with Linux in the name, calendar events with Linux in the name, folder with Linux. We have documents that within the document have Linux in there, about 100. We have conversations on email on it. We have websites and so on. So I do more emails than just three, but that's just my test account that I loaded up. And it's basically, if I look for beer, another favorite thing of mine, Linux and beer, and if we go on to Firefox, right, and so here we had three links, website links before for beer brewing. So beer brewing, I've searched already for that. Beer, ale, let's search for ales. Types of ales and lagers, here we go. At the background, it automatically updated it live. Bang, you've already got that indexed. From now on, you don't have to Google again, you don't have to go there, you already have it indexed. You know where you went. Right? You can actually also switch it off in Firefox. There's a little button if you don't want it to be indexed down there for some reason or another. And you can just switch it off. Click like that. So very easy. Usability, it's all it's about. A good website is about usability. A good OS is about usability. Not too many features. You can drive people crazy with features. Obviously, it's nice to have them if you need them, really. But if you don't need them, what's the point? You can send email with Evolution, our email client. OpenOffice. OpenOffice version 2 that we ship actually has quite a few very cool features. One of them is that you can actually open Excel macros in it. Something that our customers demanded on and on. They said, OpenOffice is all very cool, but if I can't open my financial spreadsheet, there's no point in using it. Good point. We said, and we fixed it. So let's have a look here at a spreadsheet, hypocycloids, mathematical thing for circles and circles and circles and circles. So if we open this document up, it will at some point ask me to enable the macros, so that's what I'm going to do. And here I've got now a typical macro thing where I can do some a random generation of one and get next and change them a bit. So you can see there's an Excel macro running in the backend on the fly. It's been translated in OpenOffice. The next stage will be obviously to implement Word macros, and our engineers are onto that already. So it is very exciting. We leveled the playing field. We've basically not just leveled it, we made it stable, the playing field, from our perspective. We support Word documents and many other formats. You can export directly out of OpenOffice into a PDF and open it in Acrobat Reader, which also comes shipped with our with the software. You can browse the internet with Firefox, obviously, our preferred browser. And there are other applications in there like F-Spot. I'll just have a look at that. What's F-Spot? It's a photo browser. Here we go. Now, I've got a few pictures in there, quite boring ones. Let's look at that, though. Here we go, Novell, and I can just quickly export this to Flickr. It checks my credential. I go OK. It sends it. That should open up a browser. Here we go, and I can then say OK, and it's published on Flickr, right? I think this is quite an amazing thing. Here we go. And so what we have, Dom, well, Linux has a feature called virtual desktops. It's a Unix thing, right? So you have got various desktops you can actually use. For a normal computer user, the concept of a virtual desktop, I even have difficulty to explain you what it actually is hard to understand because it's a thing that is in space somehow. It's a spatial thing. And spatial thinking, to be able to actually translate spatial thinking into something which is understandable is quite hard, can be quite hard. But what we've done is actually made a spatial thinking out of it. So my whole OS is actually a cube. If you can see, I can spin the cube. It has a bottom, a top, and a bottom, and it floats in space. I can flip the cube like that, really quickly to get you sick, and then stop like that. Here we go. What you can also do is then flip them like that, those little things, like a film strip, you know, and stop in at the various point in time like that. If you've got various applications open with Alt-Tab, the usual thing opens a little film strip like that, and then I open it up, and bang, here it is. Here we go. All those things, they use technology based on GL, basically, another standard, an open standard called OpenGL. And the technology that we implemented as a 19-year-old David Reeveman in his basement developed this idea of this cube and how to actually represent it efficiently to the user community. This makes it usable. Our testing shows that anyone can understand the concept of a virtual desktop if he thinks like a cube, right? It's a spatial thing. So why not representing it spatially and make it actually usable, a feature that is actually usability in there? For example, if I have on one desktop everything cluttered, I can just quickly move this window over here onto another one, right? Because it's all live rendered, uses GL, and uses features that are available in common cards today. If I can even do following, look at this, I can drag the window and move it like that, like a piece of paper. It just all becomes very fluid, and I can drag it like that, and it flows quite nicely. What I can also do is I can make it transparent, make it just about disappear like that.
Andreas, yeah? Just a time notice here.
All right, I'm nearly finished. Okay, I'm finished. Minimize, that's it. So basically, if you are not on Linux today, you're already using it, so you're not getting away with thinking that you're a proprietary guy. There's no way you're proprietary because you're using it every day. So you might as well join us. There's no way a monumental effort can fail. There's no way. There are too many people involved. There are not just 10 or 20, 15,000 employees of a company, literally millions. You yourself are involved because you're the users, and users are really the pinnacle of the Linux community. So what I would like to tell you today is thanks again for creating the web, for creating the possibility that Linux was successful. Without the internet, Linux wouldn't have been successful. Without Linux, the internet wouldn't have been successful because ISPs And when they started up, they did not have any money. The only way we could commoditize the internet very quickly was to use inexpensive hardware and to be able to deploy things without the worry of a licensing cost. And this is the reason you have a job. The reason you have a job is because Linux was there, because TCP/IP as an RFC-based open standard was there. So, you know, if you code next time, think about it, what you code in. And if you next time have a decision to make on what kind of hardware or OS you buy, please choose Linux. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andreas. That was excellent, and that was the most amazing Excel macro I've ever seen in my life. Also, a very funky desktop, and you can actually play with that yourselves out there at the Novell stand.